This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, Season 9, Episode 30. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the ConcealedCarry.com network. I am your host, Riley Bowman, and joined today by Brian Doc McLaughlin. Glad to have you with me for yet another episode. In fact, the third installment in our Uncensored Beginner's Guide to Training series. And today we're talking about the gear. So I think in episode one of this series, we talked about like training classes and how to evaluate instructors and different courses that you might take. The second installment, we talked about dry fire. Dry fire tools, dry fire resources. And we call that one, you know, create your dojo, set up your dojo, your dry fire dojo, that is. And so now we're going to talk about the gear, like, especially more on the live fire side of things, too, probably. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about what guns you should buy, not buy, holsters, belts, range gear, clothing, all kinds of things today. All right. So looking forward to it. Connor, thank you for joining. Man, haven't seen your name pop up in a minute. So, really cool to see. Looking forward to it, guys. Today, our episode is sponsored by KSG Armory Holsters, which, of course, you can find at ksgarmory.com. And also, let's see, EDC Belt Company. Yeah, I'm losing my mind here. EDC Belt Company's Foundation Belt, which you can find at edcbeltco.com, edcbeltco.com. And also concealedcarry.com for all the things concealed carry related. You'll actually find KSG Armory Holsters on concealedcarry.com. You'll find EDC Belt Co. Foundation Belts on concealedcarry.com. You'll find all kinds. In fact, you'll find other holsters and holster brands on concealedcarry.com. Even though we make and sell KSG Armory Holsters now, you'll find our competitors on there too. So, because concealedcarry.com is meant to be the one-stop shop for all things concealment, you know, information, education, training, resources, legal, all that. We want you to be the best informed, the best prepared, the best educated that you can be as concealed carriers, as guardians, let's say, of yourselves, of your families, your homes, your communities. And so, guys, appreciate your support of us, what we do. ConcealedCarry.com, our brands, KSG Armory being one of those brands, EDC Belt Company now also is one of those brands as well. And so, thank you. Without your support, it wouldn't be possible to do the podcast all these many years that we've been doing it. And let's go ahead and talk about today's topic. Unless you have anything you want to add about products or sponsors.
Well, concealedcarry.com, all the stuff we're going to be talking about, you can buy all that stuff on concealedcarry.com. So we try to stock it with top quality stuff. So that's where you find it.
For good prices too.
Yeah.
It's always been a priority for us to try to bring quality products to people they can afford. So, all right, the gear.
Let's get into it.
Yeah.
Everybody loves the gear.
It's true. I mean, like psychologically, people tend to be more attracted to things and products as far as providing a solution for problems, mm-hmm. as opposed to putting in work, individual work, meaning obtaining knowledge and understanding concepts and practicing things, you know, to develop skill. Like, I mean, honestly, be honest with yourselves. It's true of myself. I mean, I've certainly done it and I probably still do it in various respects. But have you ever thought, there's this, you know, problem I have and, oh, if I buy this new widget, it'll make my life better somehow.
Right? It'll make me faster or stronger or better.
Smarter. Whatever, right? As opposed to, well, maybe if you just like worked harder or learned a new skill or whatever, you know, maybe that would actually be better for you in the long run, mm-hmm. and would actually fix the problem that you're trying to solve. And frankly, the truth is that there's so many things. I mean, there's only so much that gear and equipment can do for us.
I think for my own personal example, when I first started shooting and getting really into the training aspect and I wanted to get faster, one of the things I thought of was a red dot sight. You know, if I put a red dot on my gun, it's going to turn me into John Wick, right? You know, I'm going to be able to shoot faster and more accurately, obviously. Mm-hmm. But then the first time I picked up a gun with a red dot on it, and I was like, "Ooh, that was actually a little bit of a learning curve here. I wasn't just pick up and use it and shoot. There's actually technique that's involved that I had to learn in order to use that tool effectively." So yes, did it make me faster and more accurate? I would say yes, but it took me a while to learn how to use it until it did make me fast and accurate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a good example, actually. I mean, because I do think that there are some big advantages to things like red dots on, or, you know, optics on pistols today.
Yeah.
And it is becoming more the norm. More and more you see guns coming right from the store with optics already on them. So I do think that, I mean, we're there, and that's the future. And there's reasons for that, and there are definitely advantages. As a long time now, I mean, I've been running pistols with a red dot in some fashion now, not nearly as long as some of my friends. I mean, like, I was thinking about Dave Spaulding, who I remember wrote an article in like 2004 talking about using, you know, he had to have a slide custom milled. That sort of thing didn't really exist at that time. I think it was David Bowie, who's Bowie Tactical Concepts, known for doing kind of higher end custom upgrade and accessorization and things like that to pistols. And I think it was David Bowie that had to cut that specifically for about the only red dot that was small enough at that time that existed, which was the old, I think it was Dr. Optics or something. Was like, it's kind of like the precursor to today's Shield RMSC size and design of optic. And yeah, I actually dug, I think it was Dave that actually shared it, and I dug up that old article and read it. And, you know, he'd already been using that for some time at that point even. And so again, that's fairly early, that's 20 years ago. If you think about it, I think it was 2004, maybe it was 2006, but it was in that era. So it's like either almost, or it was 20 years ago that, you know, there were some dudes out there, and Dave thinks he's one of the earliest, or if not the earliest, to do that, a slide ride optic on a handgun like that. Prior to that, optics were on guns going back into the 80s, but they were tubular and they were large. They were chunky, you know, like the OG aimpoint optics were like, they were scopes, you know, and you only saw them on like the high end race guns that were used in competition. So anyway, sorry. You got me excited there for a minute. Point is, I've been using it red dot since 2017. I think it was when I first put one on a gun and started shooting. So that's 7 years now of experience. There's a reason why people are liking them and using them. There's advantages to them. However, in the last year or two, I've enjoyed sort of going back into iron sights a little bit more as I've been diving a little more into production division and competition, which is an iron sights only division. And I've learned that in that process, sights are just sights, right? It's just a means to get to the end, which is, I want to know if my gun's aimed well enough on target or not. And like, you can do that very well, and you can do it very fast with iron sights, and you can do it really well and very fast with a red dot. And I do think that there's some things that the red dot makes easier and faster for sure. Especially more precise or longer distance shots, I think is easier. But I appreciate you bringing that as an example, because it's just a tool, and it only can do so much. Like, you still have to have the skill that backs that up.
Wait. The cooler the gun is, the faster you don't shoot. I thought that was the rule.
Yeah, it's fun to take a completely stock gun and like blow people's minds, you know, as far as like what you can do.
Yeah,
you know, like, oh, you could do that with your gun because yours has got all these trinkets and bells and whistles, you know, on it. And it's like, no, let me see your gun.
You know that quote, right? It's not the brush, it's the artist.
Yes. I was thinking the Indian and the arrow thing.
Yeah,
same concept, right?
Yeah, same work.
Yeah, exactly.
Artistry.
So, yep,
skill.
Yeah. So anyway, we're starting off here just talking about that it's more of a thing, and I think it is psychological in nature. I think that human beings are attracted to, here's a tool, here's an object that makes my life easier in some fashion, and that's certainly true in many respects. And so we're attracted to that. It's like, oh, I can just buy this thing and that will make me a better shooter. That'll make me a better concealed carrier. Like if I could just get this new fancy sounding named holster, you know, like that's going to suddenly make my life a lot better. And that may be true, but it may not be true. There's, in fact, a lot of examples of things where that's not true.
Well, I think the issue here becomes understanding how it improves your life. As a beginner, you don't understand the gear and the philosophy behind how to use it. So yeah. It's the same example of like if you have a extremely fast Lamborghini, you're not going to be able to drive that like a Formula One driver would, right? You have to develop those types of skills or else you're going to wreck that car and cause yourself a lot of problems. You know, and I think that's the same basic kind of concepts. You start off with a nice little Ford sedan and you learn how to drive with that. And then when you upgrade to that Lambo, you're going to see and you're going to know the difference between that and that, you know, that little work vehicle that you had before. Yep. You know, you're not going to be able to recognize the differences between your Lambo if you just start off driving a Lambo. You know, it's going to have so many features you're not going to understand how to use efficiently.
And oh, yeah.
You're just going to be driving that around like you normally would a Ford sedan. So there's this stark difference between your experience level and how much quality you can get out of your gear, how much usefulness you can get out of it, because you just don't understand how to use it appropriately.
Right. We certainly do see that. I mean, I've encountered it in classes as an instructor, or even just seeing folks at a competition where, you know, they've got that high end tricked out gun, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, sometimes even maybe $1,000, $7,000, you know, like high end 2011 yeah. style pistol with all of the fancy, you know, cuts and you know, it's fit well and it's got the fancy optic mounted on it and, you know, and all this stuff, right? I mean, beautiful gun, and yet the person wielding it is not that good at using it. So
can't hit the broadside of a barn is a phrase I've heard in the past.
So yes, how I think of gear is that it doesn't buy you skill, but it helps remove some what I think gear does the most of is remove some roadblocks to allow you to sort of flourish in the skill that you already possess.
Absolutely. I think there's the better quality your gear is, the more positive the outcome or the more positive your experience is going to be. If you're trying to go to a training class and you have the really junky holster and you're pistol falls out
right.
of your holster and falls on the ground and you get disqualified from the course, that has just ruined your training opportunity and your experience. You know, so if you had a quality holster that had proper retention, then you're going to have a much more enjoyable time and much safer time additionally than if you, you know, don't procure the right gear.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah, and as you were even mentioning that example, I was reminded of it was actually Jeff Gonzalez's concealed carry instructor development course that I took a few years ago, and I think that was a 3-day class. Yeah, 3-day course. It was a good course, and we had it was actually an interesting, you know, makeup of people that were in that course. Several law enforcement officers, a couple civilians. You know, I was there, obviously. And I remember there was a cop from an agency in California somewhere, if I recall, that showed up with kind of the holster that you would expect to find and buy on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so really kind of basic cookie cutter Kydex holster. And the holster itself wasn't bad per se. I mean, it certainly was capable of getting the job done as far as, you know, what are we looking for? The holster needs to protect the trigger guard in the trigger, keep that from being fired off while in the holster, retain the gun. So, you know, it should be able to hold the gun in there while you're wearing it. It seemed like it was capable of all those things, but what it was not very capable of, and this is one of the core, you know, sort of design principles that need to be present with a quality holster, is also, you know, if you got protecting the gun and the trigger and you have it so that the gun stays in the holster when you want it to, but then you also have that third piece of it needs to stay on you when you're wearing the holster. Like, you don't want the holster falling out, right? It's not so much at that point the gun falling out of the holster. It's the holster not staying attached to you however you're wearing it. And this gentleman was finding out very quickly, these plastic clips that you often see, they're called FOMI clips. F-O-M-I. Actually stands for folded over molded injection, or I believe that's what it is. A clip. Yeah, I know. Too much detail. But that's what it is. Like, people are like, what's a FOMI clip? Well, it's actually an acronym. It comes from, you know, how that thing is designed. And they're very popular. You see, in fact, a friend just sent me a picture. They're in a training class, and that it's a kind of a unique course. The gun's provided for them in the course. The holster's provided along with it that fits the gun. So they're taking the training. They get the gun. They get the holster. They're going through the course, and sends me the picture. And I mean, everything looks fine as far as, I mean, looks like they're getting really good training, by the way. The guns look like they're great. They seem like they're working well. And the holsters look okay, except that I picked up on the fact that they're using FOMI clips. Mm-hmm. So whoever's making those holsters, you know, is still using those FOMI clips. And I mentioned this because, you know, part of what we're talking about today is some things not to buy. And we're going to talk about holsters specifically too, some more, even though I'm kind of already getting to that. But I saw that and I was like, okay, we're using FOMI clips. Well, this cop from California in this Jeff Gonzalez class I was in, that's how that holster was designed. I mean, it met all the other requirements, but the one it sucked at big time was the clip. Mm-hmm. And I was next to that person on the firing line throughout the course. And so I had plenty of opportunities to witness this as probably no fewer than 5 or 6 times as he drew his gun, the holster, everything came off the belt.
Yeah. Well, I think I have 2 thoughts on this. One, this is what experience teaches you.
Yep.
Training teaches you how your gear works. So this dude learned a hard lesson that day.
Yep.
But he learned a valuable lesson. If he tried to use that pistol in a defensive shooting, having never been to the range, he would have never figured out that his holster was a piece of garbage.
Exactly.
Training is an excellent test. Not a perfect testing ground, obviously, but it's a reasonable testing ground for our equipment so that we, when we actually take it out to go do stuff, we know it's going to do what we need to do. It's also our opportunity to customize our gear so that it does what we want it to do. Maybe he needs to upgrade his retention. Maybe he needs to get better clips, all those types of things. So this is a perfect time for you to be trying all that stuff out. You got new piece of gear, be running that on the range. If you're going to be using that to save your life, make sure you're going out and running it through all its paces. Additionally, those FOMI clips, like you said, in the grappling world, that's a big no-no.
Yeah,
you will rip those things apart.
Correct.
They are terrible. So if somebody's coming after your weapon for weapon retention and that kind of thing, and you're trying to fight somebody, good chance that's going to get ripped apart immediately. So gear selection is kind of one of those important things that encompasses a broad category, not only in the training and sport world, but also in fighting, combat, and defensive. Yeah.
And today we're going to talk about guns. We're going to talk about holsters. We're going to talk about belts. We're going to talk about a bunch of things. And it's important to understand that all of these things sort of operate together as a system. Mm-hmm. So, because you could look at this gentleman from California that had his holster keep coming off his belt and go, well, was the belt the problem? Which is a fair question to ask. And I'll answer that right now is that there are certainly, in my opinion, better belts than what he had, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say the problem was the belt. Mm. I actually thought the belt was fine. I mean, it's not an EDC belt company foundation belt, like what I'm assuming you're wearing one too, what I'm wearing. I don't think the problem was the belt. The problem was, that's a poor design of a holster clip, and it's the most common one used, especially in the lower end priced, you know, holster category. The stuff you see online on especially like Amazon, like I'm not going to say there's bad products or that there aren't good products that you can buy on Amazon, including good holsters. In fact, at one point you might see KSG Army holsters on Amazon. I don't know. When we're ready to be able to do something like that, maybe we will. But there's a lot of junk on there.
Their quality is a little harder to find
on
Amazon. You got to really do some searching. And part of the thing is, like, I might buy something on Amazon, but I'll go and research the website of that company before I actually buy it off of Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, because Amazon's super convenient, but you don't know what you're going to get. A lot of this stuff is coming out. It's not the best quality, but they do sell, you know, normal everyday concealed carry holsters that are top quality.
Yeah.
But a lot of this is experience. You know, you're going to buy junk. You're just going to. That's just part of the process. Yeah. You're going to see something. You're going to think it's really cool. You're going to try it out and you're going to be like, ah, this isn't even for me. And it might even be something that's a very popular, very well-respected item, and it just might not work for you, you know, and that's totally reasonable as well. A big part of this is playing, getting out, experimenting, trying out different things and techniques and seeing what works for you and what doesn't, and customizing the gear for you. And that's where you start to make that transition from your basic, your newbie shooter to your more advanced levels.
Right. Yeah, no, you're not wrong. That is entirely true. That, I mean, part of the reason we're even doing this Uncensored Beginner's Guide series is because of lessons I had to learn, lessons you had to learn, lessons Jacob, who's not with us on this episode today, had to learn through experience. That I bought this, I tried that, and it did not work. That's our hope with this episode is to help you avoid some of that. Along the way, you're probably going to still, you know, make some mistakes, but we hope to minimize those as much as possible.
That's what I love most about the basics type of thing, is because I get to talk about how I did everything the hard way. All of these things that we're talking about has been me. I have been on the range with a whole line of shooters, and they've all been waiting on me because my gear has been falling apart because I didn't take the time to make sure it was good to go ahead of this training schedule. Right. Yeah. And so that was a valuable lesson. Like, that sucks being that guy, but now I'm going to try really hard not to make that happen again. So I learned a valuable lesson. That's part of the experience process. Yeah. Just lean into it, you know, accept that you're going to make the mistakes and don't beat yourself up too bad about it, and just move on. Just make sure you learn your lesson.
Yeah. Awesome. Good thoughts. Well, so let's talk about buying your first gun, or I guess if it's not necessarily your first gun, but I mean, let's just talk about guns.
What was your first gun that you bought for yourself with your own money?
Oh man, you put me on the spot, and a little bit embarrassing to mention. Understand though, I was like 21 years old.
There's no wrong answers here, Riley. Oh, you're with friends,
dude. No, this I know some people out there, some of my friends will crack up, and a few of you know. But I was like 21, you know, just excited to be 21 and able to walk into a gun store and buy a pistol, right? And I also didn't have a lot of money at the time, so I went into. If anyone's familiar, it's more popular in kind of the like Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, maybe Montana region, Cal Ranch stores, which is like a farm and ranch, you know, store. And I walk into a Cal Ranch store, and I mean, I'm looking at all the guns, you know, and of course there's Glocks and there's all these things, and you know, those are $400, $500, $600, and I'm like, well, I don't have that much. I bought a High Point in 380. Because I don't think they had the 9mm available today. And I was like, well, I'll take the 380.
380 will
work. Yeah. For $89.
Ooh, a steal. What a deal.
And so, yeah, that was my first gun, dude.
That's pretty classic.
And I mean, it worked okay for my purposes at the time.
Sure. Well, buying drugs? Is that what? Keep yourself safe on the drug use. Yeah, I got it. No, hey, no way. Everybody's got to need their thing.
You know, I actually kind of wish I still had that gun just for the almost like memorabilia aspect of it. You know, like,
I never get rid of guns.
That's certainly true of me today, I would say. But I would kind of like to have that because
history.
Know, that was the first handgun I ever purchased. Yeah.
So yeah, see, we know. Yeah. We get it.
What was your first? Come on now.
Well, I mean, I would say my very first that I bought with my own money, I saved up $100 and I bought that Marlin tubular magazine. I don't remember the model number.
Model 60.
The Marlin Model 60. That was my first gun I ever bought. Yep. I saved up $100 and I bought that when I was 10.
That's the first gun I ever bought. It was a Marlin Model 60.
Yeah. See? Same. And you learn to shoot with that. Like, that's an excellent first gun to get. It's not very scary. It's super cheap to shoot. It's really fun, especially if you get up into the mountains, you get to plink cans. Kids love that. But my first official legal gun was
handgun.
Handgun. My first legal handgun was a M&P 9.
Yeah. So you did a lot better than I did.
My first real long gun that I purchased was a 870 Express.
Oh. So, I like how you put that, though. My first legal gun I purchased. Apparently, you didn't purchase the Model 60 legally.
I didn't always used to be an upstanding human being.
Wink, wink. Sure, we're past the statute of limitations.
Yeah, at some point in some places, maybe.
So,
all right. So, buying your first gun. So, what would you recommend? What would be a So I know one of the most important parts is what is your purpose? Mm-hmm. What do you think? How would someone identify the purpose of their?
That's true, but let's stay like we're talking primarily concealed carry context,
okay,
or self defense context today.
Sure,
right. So let's address that question in that context, okay? Because I do think that if we make it much broader than that, there, I mean, like you just said a minute ago, like, well, for a first gun, a Model 60 is not a bad choice. You know, Marlin, it's a semi-automatic 22 long rifle, if you're not familiar. We probably should explain that. You know, Ruger 10/22, very similar, and also a very common first gun choice for a lot of people, kids, families. Could be one of those bolt action 22s, right? You know, it could be something else entirely. I mean, I actually wouldn't even mind starting out some people with an AR-15, you know, just because they're easy to shoot. And they're readily available. They're, I think, quite affordable. At least you can find affordable ones because they're so common, you know. And I mean, yeah, there's some manual of operations there that need to be figured out, but they're easy to learn to shoot because mm-hmm. they don't, you know, there's not a lot of recoil, right? And so, anyway, that's neat. So, but let's focus on the concealed carry aspect, and I'd like to actually hear from you your thoughts on. What do you think people should be considering or looking at, and whether you want to mention specific guns or gun types or not, I don't know. That's up to you. But what do you think when someone's looking at, okay, a gun I'm going to buy, again, this is the uncensored beginner's guide, a gun I'm going to buy for concealed carry or self-defense purposes.
I know, one of the most common things that I've noticed in, purchasing a new gun is a lot of people assume that the size of the gun means the recoil or the scariness of the gun. So pretty often I see a lot of people who are more timid around firearms. They try to go and find themselves and that's a nice small gun that they think is going to be less scary to shoot. And I know from my experience, the smaller pocket pistol type of guns that tend to get purchased for concealed carry by those types of people are not that fun to shoot. In particular, I'm thinking about the LCP or the LC9. The LC9 wasn't quite as bad, but the LCP was surprisingly uncomfortable and unfun to shoot. You know, and if you have a firearm that is not fun to train with, you're not going to train with it, in my opinion. So I think a lot of things that come into it is kind of identifying what it is that you're trying to do. So if you're purchasing this gun for self-defense, a very common, considered thing is the 9mm is generally considered across the board to be acceptable for recoil management and for stoppability. A lot of people have these ideas. Sometimes you get this big beefy dude who doesn't know a whole lot about guns. I need the biggest gun possible to get a point across and that kind of thing. So a lot of times I like to, you know, kind of caution people to, you know, not pay so much close attention to the size of the weapon and what that's going to do for you, but make sure that you're going for the shootability. So something that's reliable and relatively inexpensive. Glocks are fantastic, M&Ps, you know, your basic Ruger models. And then you can go up from there if you want to get more technical, spend more money. You can absolutely do that. But starting with something in the range of about $400 to $800 seems to be like kind of the appropriate category, I would say, for a beginner pistol in that area. You can certainly go higher and lower depending on what you do and where you get it. But that seems to be like the category of like your basic stock model pistol that you can kind of take to the range, learn how to shoot, and then upgrade from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. You said a lot of good stuff there that I agree that it is not uncommon for people, especially if their context, like you pointed out earlier that we need to be asking what the purpose is of why I'm buying the gun that I'm buying. And if, when we're thinking concealed carry, a lot of people, they're like, hey, well, that's, I need to be able to conceal it. You need to be able to hide it, you know, that kind of thing. And so,
and they like the Derringer coming out, you know, idea.
So they buy something very small. It's not uncommon. And you're exactly right that those are, they're hard to grip. They're hard to shoot. They're hard to train with. They're hard to put a lot of rounds through. And honestly, a lot of those really small guns, especially, they're not built. I mean, they're small. I mean, you have to understand every time this little explosion is going off inside that gun as rounds are fired. I mean, that takes a toll on steel and materials. And, you know, a full size gun is going to handle that way better long term than something small. And so small guns are hard to train with and do so regularly without eventually, you know, breaking stuff and having more parts and maintenance that needs to be, you know, taken care of. And so that's where we see a lot of people begin, is by buying small guns for concealed carry, especially. In my own journey, I mean, I went through kind of this whole cycle of, I already told you what the very first handgun was that I ever bought. And I did carry that for a time. It didn't last that long. But I sort of went from mid-size to kind of another mid-size to like, oh, this is kind of hard to conceal, to something small or something smaller. I mean, I ended up with an LCP at 1.2. So went all the way to like very, very small guns. And then the part of the reason for that, by the way, was because I wasn't using good holsters. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, the concern being, well, I need to be able to conceal this. This isn't, you know, this mid-size gun or compact gun is not working well enough. So I got to go smaller, smaller, smaller. And then you're like, but now I'm compromising on all kinds of things, compromising on shootability, compromising on ammo capacity. That's a consideration. I mean, I've carried guns with, you know, 6-round capacity, and which that's a whole other topic for another time, because there's times I still carry a you know, it's specific context, but there's times, well, I'm perfectly happy to carry a 5-shot J frame, you know, 38 special, but you're still compromising there. Right. And so then I sort of came back towards, you know, bigger and bigger guns, to the point where I, for a number of years, carried full size guns. Granted, I'm a large framed mammal. But that was made possible because then I started figuring out concealment better, holsters better, you know, all that. And so that's sort of the cycle and the journey that I went through. And, here's my advice for someone looking to buy their first gun. I used to have a much more nuanced answer, and I still have the nuanced answer, because there's a lot of variables and a lot of things to consider. But if you just want a simple answer, then what I tell people is like, okay, just go buy a Glock 19. Hmm. And keep in mind, this is a concealed carry podcast brought to you by HK. but what's cool is HK is cool with us, you know, in saying what we're saying. I know that, because
the point remains. Like, you know, I think your point is good.
Now, if you want to go buy a VP9 or something, that's cool too. Like, you could do, like, it's also an acceptable choice. But here's why I say, you know, if you want just the one word answer, or maybe two, or whatever, Glock 19. Why? Well, because let me answer that by saying, here's what happens to a lot of people. They buy a gun that they like for whatever reason. Sometimes it's just because they like the way it feels. They like the shape of its grip. They like how they can reach the controls with their thumb. They don't have to adjust their grip to hit the mag release or whatever. Which, by the way, is not a big deal, because I break my grip every time I change a magazine. But anyway. And so they end up buying some gun, you know, that they like for whatever reason. Okay. And so sometimes you end up with some pretty obscure stuff, meaning not a Glock 19, because Glock 19s are so universal in today's, you know, gun buying world. I mean, because you can walk into any store and buy a Glock.
You can also resell them really easy. You can
buy magazines in basically any store for a Glock. You can buy a holster for a Glock pretty much anywhere, right? It is like, there's so many advantages to keeping it simple and just buying a Glock. Now, Glock 19 might be a little big for some of you to carry and conceal, so that's fair. Although, I know people that are not that big, like very, very small statured, and are able to carry and conceal a Glock 19. Yeah. And so, I say Glock 19 as opposed to, say, even like a Glock 17 or whatever, because I think it's just big enough that people with normal size hands, and I say normal women can run a Glock 19, normal size dudes can run a Glock 19. Big or small, you can usually make it work. There, you know, sometimes there's some challenges with some smaller hands, but for most people, you can make it work and you can shoot it acceptably well. Maybe not the best trigger, maybe not the best sights or whatever, but you can make it work. Why? Because I've seen a lot of people do it. And I ran a stock Glock 19 for a long time.
I'm still running a stock Glock.
Yeah, right? Like, and so there's just so many advantages, and people disadvantage themselves when they buy something kind of obscure. And by obscure, I mean, I'm talking about, like, you know, not to diss any one particular gun or brand, but I mean, just to give you an example, it could be a Canik, you know, TP9 SFX or something like that. You know, well, where can you find a holster for that? I mean, you can find a few companies that sell one, right? But you're not going to find it, chances are, in your local gun store. If for some reason you're in an immediate need for a holster, we don't even make holsters currently for any Canics at all, though it's something I hope to change in the relatively near future. Another example, how about a Walther PPQ?
I was just about to say that. I was thinking the PPK personally, but...
Oh, that's another example.
Get the old James Bond weapon
right,
going.
Right? Yeah, you know, like, okay, like the PPQ, great gun, all right? But harder to find holsters, magazines, all of that for, right? And so you're on this journey of, number one, needing to learn how to use your equipment. So you want something that you can shoot well enough and can learn well enough on. So it needs to be kind of big enough to make that doable and make it easy. So that's why not going with a smaller gun is, you know, makes sense to me, because it's harder to learn to shoot with a smaller gun. And then again, this is a concealed carry journey. You need to get quality equipment that works with that gun now. And so you need a quality holster. Well, where are you going to find that? Okay. You need other things that go along with that. Other accessories, let's say. Maybe you want to swap out the sights to something that, you know, works for your eyes better. And you go onto some, you know, website looking to buy a set of sights, and you're like, I can't find the sights for PPK. Actually, I don't think you can swap out sights on those. I think, especially the front sight, I know, I'm pretty sure is a fixed sight. So, you know, I mean, like, you just make your life so much more difficult when you kind of go out into the weeds. And I'm not saying, like, people can't choose for themselves what they want, but this is my advice. All right. And the other thing too is that we're talking defensive or concealed carry context. Reliability is super important. And sometimes you just don't know what you're going to get with some of these other
less reputable brands.
I don't know if I would say less reputable, you just sometimes don't know what you're going to get. You know what I mean? But you know what you're going to get with a Glock.
Well,
and for that matter, you know what you're going to get with an HK too, like high quality. Going to run.
What do you feel about people going to a gun range and renting their top five picks and trying those out? How do you feel about that?
See, so like, what's the purpose of that?
Test them out, feel the ergonomics, find out which one feels best to you.
Yeah. And see, that's and I used to say something very similar to that.
Yeah.
And so here's my response to that. You are brand new to this. You don't even know what feels good. You don't even know what works good.
That's true.
Because you don't have enough frame of reference, skill-wise, to be like, that works better for me than that. You don't even know probably how to evaluate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize we're not talking to all of you that are like brand new, looking to do this for the first time sort of thing. But in that context, like, talk about buying your first gun for concealed carry or first gun in general. You don't even know, like, honestly, what matters. Because I'm speaking from experience, because that was me once upon a time. But yet, I would choose a gun based on, oh, I liked the way it looked, or I liked the way it felt. You know what? Who cares how your gun feels in your hand? I know, so the counter argument to that is, but who's going to want to shoot their gun if it doesn't feel good? Shooting a gun doesn't feel good anyway. Like, it goes bang, 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 and pounds into your hand every time. Like, there's nothing natural about shooting a gun. And I know, like, the argument against Glocks is, well, it feels like a 2x4 in my hand. Okay. Guess what? It's a 2x4 that works.
Yeah.
And you can learn to shoot it. I used to be that guy too. I was like, I don't like the way Glocks feel. It's so like, it's like a 2x4.
Blocky.
Yeah, blocky. Like, I hate the ergonomics. And then, funny enough, I ended up using and carrying and switching to Glocks for a number of years, for a lot of the reasons I'm explaining.
Mm-hmm.
One, way better access to accessories, aftermarket parts, holsters, all that stuff. It just made my life simpler. And also, it was easier in the context at the time I was also doing law enforcement work on the side. And there was other reasons, you know, for that. So, but that it, through that process, I'm like, this actually isn't as bad as what I thought. You know, like, it's still a gun. And what's the process? Well, get the gun on target, aim it, you know, press trigger without moving it, hit the target. Like, guess what? A Glock does that as well as anything else. So anyway, I could probably talk more about that subject.
But so the wrap up though, right? Everything in summary is that find something that's adequate.
Yeah.
Something in the category of like maybe a Glock 19 where it's big enough that you can train with it.
You want it to be reliable. You want to be able to shoot it. You want to be able to train with it a lot. Because you need that training. You need that practice. You need to get good. Mm-hmm. Like that's part of that. That's super important part of your journey right now. Should be affordable. And, well, that's another thing. Probably should look at calibers that are, again, readily available. So obscure calibers. Like people are like, oh, I want a 45. 45 is not that obscure. However, I could still find 9mm easier and it's cheaper. And therefore, I can shoot more of it, which, again, reinforces my desire to get better. And that, like, you could say, well, 380. Well, but 380s are usually more expensive still to buy ammo for. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing that I, you know, that's where my mind goes is make your journey as simple, as efficient, as low cost as possible while making sure you're using quality, reliable equipment.
Yeah. You can always complicate things later. Like, you starting off being super simple. I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Yeah. I have one more thing to add because this, and this is the nuance. This is the nuance. Because a Glock 19 is not going to be the answer for everybody. And so you might go, well, what about a 43X or a 48 or maybe, I don't know, something else entirely, a P365, let's say. Okay. Those are all also fine, acceptable choices. And based on your context and how, you know, just the shape, size of your body, how you dress, where you intend on being carrying this gun the most, like you may have to make other decisions there that take in some of that nuance. In which case, if you end up having to compromise and buy a smaller gun that maybe, you know, it's harder to shoot, harder to train with, maybe hopefully you can save up and buy a second gun that you can also get some training with. I'm a huge advocate that, yes, you want to train and practice with the gun you carry. And if you carry a P365 every day, like you want to practice and train with that. However, learning to shoot on a P365 is not as easy and as efficient as part of your journey than learning to shoot on a full-size P320. Mm. So, anyway, just there's definitely more nuance there and things to consider, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Holsters.
Holster basics. So this is pretty standard for everybody to get that. The term now has been kind of synonymous, which is kind of hard for Uncle Mike, but Uncle Mike's holsters are kind of one of those holsters that you see in the industry. If somebody says, hey, you got a Uncle Mike's holster, generally that's something that's made out of nylon, maybe might not hold your weapon very well. It's probably not made especially for your weapon. It's probably one of those holsters that's kind of like a universal holster, which is never a great idea in my opinion. I've never run into a universal holster that I felt like was really a very good quality one. You want something that's kind of specifically made for your exact firearm. But what are some of the basics of holster? Being a holster expert, so you do a lot of the KSG that you're building them from the ground up.
Sure.
So what are
sure.
some of the things that you look for in a holster? What sticks out as quality versus not quality?
So let's make sure we talk about, you know, the design principles, or I guess you could call them almost rules, because really these things need to exist from a safety standpoint with respect to a holster, mm-hmm. which I already touched on earlier, so I'm just rehashing them. Number one, it's gotta protect the gun from being able to be fired while the gun is holstered, right? So that implies that the trigger guard and the trigger itself has got to be protected adequately so it can't be pressed through the holster or you know, something gets slip in through a gap somewhere and press on the whole, on the trigger, or that kind of thing. So trigger guard, trigger got to be protected. Go ahead.
One thing that I noticed is a lot is some people don't feel like they need a holster. You know, if you're starting out,
that's fair.
Very often they'll buy a gun, but then they won't buy a holster. And pretty often I will caution those people, be like, this is like a sword without a scabbard. Say you got right. a razor sharp sword. Are you just going to be walking around with this thing and potentially cutting yourself and everybody else? Like, no, you need to have a scabbard. You can't just have a sword and running around on the battlefield. You got to have a way to put it away so that it's safe to walk around with it. Holsters are a lot like that. So making
I love
sure
that example,
that.
By the way, because I was just thinking of, you know, a true swordsmith, you know, not only makes the sword, but also puts a lot of thought and time and attention to detail in the design of the scabbard itself, right?
Huge deal.
Like it's a system. Mm-hmm. They got to go together. They got to be fit for each other. They've got to work together. They got to, you know, all those things. And that's the same for, a gun and a holster for sure.
Rifles and slings, swords and scabbards, pistols and holsters.
Yep. There you go. I love it. That's awesome. Yeah. So got to keep the gun from firing while in the holster. Number two, The gun's got to be retained in the holster and got to stay there until you want it to come out. Number three, it's got to be retained to the body, right? So we talked about that with, you know, the clip coming loose and the holster coming out on the draw. That's a problem. I feel like there's a fourth thing that I should mention, and I don't remember what it is right now. But those are like the big three for sure. Those are the big three. That's where I you know, focus most of my time, making sure that a holster's got to definitely meet those three criteria. Beyond that, what makes a quality holster assuming we meet the basic safety standards, there's a lot that honestly goes into the thought process behind and the design involved in a holster. And keep in mind, and I'm thinking mostly in the concealed carry context here. So concealed carry holsters, which are usually going to be inside waistband of some fashion, usually, not always, but that's the most common. That's what we focus on making is inside waistband and appendix inside waistband holsters. And so let me focus on that because that's where most of you will probably land. And so what are some of the things that go into designing that and making it work? So let's just address standard inside waistband, usually worn on or maybe slightly behind the hip by a lot of folks. Usually that's going to have a little bit of a forward cant incorporated into the design. Usually you want that holster to if you're carrying again on the hip or behind the hip, to match the length of the gun in that position. More length is not helping you generally. And I'll explain why that's relevant here in a minute when I talk about appendix inside waistband holsters. But so typically you're going to want that holster to match the length of the gun. I find that two clip arrangements usually work better than one, because what happens on that hip is you're constantly, like, your hip is a hinge, right? And so you get up, you stand up straight, you sit down, you bend over. And you get up and you bend over and you get up and you bend over and you get up. And what happens is here's that holster and that gun sitting on that hinge. And for the ones that are designed with just like a single clip, over time, what typically happens is the holster that you had perfectly positioned basically works itself kind of back and forth, and it's going to be in a slightly different position than the one you placed it in. Mm-hmm. Whether that's actual position horizontally, like on your belt, I've seen them start to slide their way, you know, just work their way, you know, maybe a little bit further backwards. But the other thing is you'll see that cant, that, you know, whatever angle it is that you feel is optimal for you to be able to draw and present that gun, it'll rotate and not be in that same position. And so that's going to affect your ability to get a proper index on the gun to actually, you know, establish that grip on the gun. Mm-hmm. It may not be in the same position. So your hand may go to a different spot than where the gun is. And so, oh, now you're fumbling for that a little bit. You may not get your grip established the same way. So now your grip is somewhat compromised. And so now you're not presenting the gun to the target as cleanly, as efficiently, or as on target as you'd like it to be. And so single clips at or behind the hip generally don't work super well. What works the best for single clip solutions I've seen is the DCC monoblock, which is a popular clip solution now. It's kind of been the thing that now is starting to replace the foamy clips of old. And we already addressed those in the beginning of the episode. And the monoblock is a solid product. It's like a singular clip, but it's got two clips really incorporated into one, which not only is an extra safety feature in terms of retention of the holster to you, because if somehow one of those clips worked their way up the belt, it's not likely both of them will, because they work independently, even though they're ultimately part of the same clip, but each of those individual, you know, fingers, if you will, of, you know, it's like two fingers of a clip, they work independently of each other. So that's good. The monoblock does a great job too of applying some inward pressure on the body of the holster itself once it's clipped over. So it, you know, kind of pinches itself in there better than some of the other products. It's got a lot of spring tension to it. It's actually made from spring steel. So that helps with that.
Yeah. Not molded injected plastic. So it's that much more robust. Yeah. Coming from the grappling world, like that is a far more robust retention device for your holster. That's it's not coming off. Right. Unless you want it to. So,
right. Exactly. So the monoblock seems to do okay in that traditional IWB location. Okay. You don't often have or need a wing in that IWB position. However, those can be a help. And so, I at least like having the option available to customers. And so if they want to have a wing on their IWB holster, they can. It might protrude a little bit above the belt, depending on cant angle, but it'll still have some effect there. What is a wing? The wing is the piece on a holster. You know, I meant to have one handy here and I don't.
Got one up there on the table.
Well, this is real easy.
Oh, you got it on. Yeah.
We'll just keep the, you know, the gun in the holster, right? But this is the wing right here. Those of you that are watching, okay, this side piece, this protrusion. It's a little L-shaped piece. There are other designs and companies out there that make them, but this acts as a lever that helps bring the grip of the gun in towards the body, right? And so the wing is a critical design element to the modern Kydex holster because usually what we see printing on people is the grip of the gun. It's the longest protrusion. It's sitting above the belt. And if this is not in line with the belt or in line with the body, the grip, that is, it's going to protrude forward away from you. And that's going to present the concealment challenge. And so the wing or claw, as they're also referred to, in this case, this product's known as the Mod Wing, which is probably the most popular one that's used. It for a variety of reasons. It's a good product. It's well made. It's strong. It's also ambidextrous, or you can reverse it. So it's a single, you know, item that allows us to easily make holsters with wings for both left-handed and right-handed shooters. And again, this wing can still work in IWB behind the hip position. It can be a little bit challenging to get the holster put on you because you got to kind of work that wing inside the pant as you're doing that. And as you can see with this is a Case G Armory Lexington holster. I can set up two clips. I can set up single clips. I can set up soft loops with this, including with cant. I can actually use canted DCC clips, and you know, and then I'm able to position this with a forward cant.
So cant means the angle of the holster.
Right, right. Zero cant being where essentially the barrel is pointing perfectly straight up and down. Mm-hmm. Forward cant being that the barrel is kind of pointing rearward as you're wearing it, meaning that it brings the grip a little bit more forward. And that's part of the reason why it's then easier for you to grab when it's back here on your hip. That's why people do that forward cant. A reverse cant would obviously be the reverse of that, where the muzzle is more pointing forward. That's less common, less typical. If we see that at all in a concealment context, it's usually because the person's wearing
a cross draw,
kind of a cross draw type setup.
Yeah,
which is not as common today, partly because it just doesn't work as well as what people once thought it did.
It looks really cool though.
So yeah, wing. It's something, you know, like more and more holster companies are using them. Sounds like you had something to add or a question.
Well, just to recap, so for people who are new, what makes a pistol concealable isn't the length of the slide or the barrel. It's more about the length of the grip. So you were talking about that.
Well, in this context, especially so. But in the appendix position, so forward of the hips, that changes a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's because our physiology, our you know, the shape of our body, the makeup of our body, the all that changes when we go in front of the hip versus behind the hip. I mean, think about it. Behind the hip, what do I got? Well, at some point there, I've got, you know, a little booty, you know, and like that, that, you know, it's less likely that my gun is going to tip outward because there's not space for it to do it so much there. But when we go forward to the hip, we all get, no matter our size, like you could be overweight, underweight, doesn't really matter. We have a natural depression in the body in the groin region. Okay. And so if you're wearing forward to the hips, you're positioning that gun, basically in between your legs in the front. And what that means is you have the slide and the barrel and the, you know, the protrusion of the holster, the lower portion, that's all below the belt. That's in front there. And you have a natural depression in your body there. Like that's just the way we're shaped, right? No matter how, you know, whatever size, height, weight we are, like there's a natural depression there. And so appendix carry, and this is where design becomes a little bit more important to a holster because it has to be done with purpose. Mm-hmm. And what I see is a lot of holster companies that don't understand what needs to be considered in the appendix carry position. And so the number one thing, honestly, for most people is having too short of a holster in the appendix position. Because what happens is with a short holster, you got very little gun. Like if I was to cover this up, right? You know, those of you that are able to watch. So imagine my holster is this short. Okay. Look at where the clips are and look how much gun and holster is below where the belt's going to be. Mm-hmm. And look how much is above it.
Right.
And it's, and especially talking about weight, where's all my weight? I mean, I've got 15 rounds in this gun. You know, that's weight, right? So I have all this mass up here and I've got very little mass below the belt. And so John Houtman at Filster Holsters gave this a name. He calls it the keel principle, meaning just like the keel on a ship, which is responsible for keeping the ship upright in the water. Okay. If you just made your boat like a dish and then you put a big old sail on top of it, like think of the grip and the upper portion of the gun like a sail. So if you just make a boat like a dish and put a big old sail up there, what happens when the wind blows? Mm-hmm. Just gonna tip the boat right over. So you have to have a keel on the bottom of the boat that keeps that ship upright even when the wind's blowing and pushing on the sail. So meanwhile, no matter who you are, there's a few exceptions probably. Some people are very flat in the tummy region, but most are not. Even those that look fairly skinny, still generally like we have a little more roundness in the belly than we do below the belly, right? And so think of that as your wind pushing against this sail. You got this grip and this upper portion of the gun and your belly is pushing here. And you have very little below down here balancing it out. And so this is where we get guns kind of tipping forward. And you can have a wing, and that may help bring that grip in towards the body, but it may not be enough. And it may actually be that now the upper or the kind of the back portion of the slide is now protruding a little bit because you don't have enough of a keel to balance this out. Mm-hmm. And so that's where more length becomes. And it's not always about more length. It's about sort of having the right amount of length. In my sort of rough studying of this, for average-sized human beings with typical carry guns, you want – for appendix carry position, you want a holster with a length of – like it's hard to say exactly what the holster length is, but a holster length that would be as if – regardless if the gun is or not – is about 4-inch long barrel or so, or more, perhaps. It depends on the gun, depends on the person. But somewhere around 4 inches seems to be kind of the magic number.
How long is the Glock barrel? The Glock 19?
The Glock 19 is about 4 inches.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, like on my body type and size, like I like, and it works better to have a little more length than that, like more like Glock 17 length in that holster to really balance things out and not have the top, you know, portion of the gun wanting to print outwards. Okay. And so again, it varies from person to person a little bit, but that kind of sweet spot for most people, it captures probably 80%, 85% of people is somewhere basically about the equivalent of a 4-inch barrel length.
Okay.
So your P365, for instance, just use an example, it's a very popular choice, very small, very compact. It's like a 3-inch barrel, mm-hmm. right? If you have a holster that's made for a 3-inch gun and you're trying to carry appendix, this thing is going to do this. And here's the other thing you don't realize. As the upper portion of the gun is either tilts or is pressed outward, it leverages the bottom portion of the holster into your nether region, and that becomes very, very painful. It mm-hmm. creates a hot spot. You think that more length is like, well, isn't that going to be uncomfortable here? Not when it's done correctly, tastefully. We want to minimize the width of the holster side to side, because mm-hmm. wider here is going to impinge upon, you know, our body more. But length, if done well, is often what we need. And by stabilizing this and not allowing this to get leveraged inward, the bottom portion of the holster into my lower abdomen or my groin, by not allowing that to happen, it actually becomes more comfortable.
And you get an added benefit with that wedge, yes?
Yeah. And so, you know, we sell wedges. There's other companies that sell wedges. Very easy to add one of these. It's a closed cell foam wedge with Velcro on there. Nice thing about the Velcro is, as you can see here, maybe you can hear in the mic for those listening, I can reposition this a variety of different ways. I can even change the angle of it. I can make this suit my preference, my body type. You can see where I kind of have mine. That's actually a little bit low. I kind of have my wedge sort of wrap around the bottom edge of the holster. It increases comfort just a little bit better there. And that wedge is a wedge-shaped piece of material. In this case, again, it's closed cell foam, so it's comfortable. It's not hard. But this is purpose-built, so it gives me even more keel effect. So it really helps the upper portion of the gun tuck in a little bit closer, because I basically want this portion of the gun to rest as much as possible more flat with my body, mm-hmm. right? And the bigger you are, the bigger belly you have, probably the more wedge you're going to need, just so you know. And that's why we sell wedges of different sizes and thicknesses and things like that. So you can also, you know, you can order those on ksgarmory.com.
So what would you tell somebody who is new and worried about carrying appendix? You know, worried about shooting themselves in the junk.
It becomes a common, you know, thing. And that's actually the running joke, right? Well, you're going to shoot your junk off, right? And so I would say that, you know, caution should be exercised. But caution should be exercised for anybody that's carrying a gun concealed. Here's what I would say about appendix carry. If you are careful, if you're using a good holster, and you, let me back up just a little bit on that. Talked about the holster aspect. Okay. So like this holster with where I position it, which is kind of like about if my belly button's 12 o'clock, it's like 12:30, 1 o'clock, probably let's just say 1 o'clock position on my body. Not that I'm going to give you that camera angle. Nobody wants to see this. But, you know, like if I'm wearing gym shorts or something and something more open on the bottom, when I'm wearing my holster in the appendix position and my gun's not in there, I actually see daylight through the holster, through my short, you know, through the shorts themselves and right down to my feet, between my feet, I should say. So this is actually not pointing at me when I'm standing. I sit, okay, yes, this is going to probably be pointing at a portion of my leg. Mm-hmm. That's true. However, I mean, I'm waving around, I'm joking somewhat, but waving around this gun in a holster, and hopefully nobody's freaked out by that, but it's a gun in a holster that's safe. Like, it's inert. It's not going to fire while it's in this holster, right? And so, when a gun's in a holster, it's considered essentially inert.
So, the most dangerous times are
drawing and reholstering. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, let's address that. First of all, I try to never... And I mean, like in practice and in training, things like that, I try to never draw or reholster while seated. Okay. I'll do it in dry fire. I'll do it with a barrel block installed. And I will do it in limited instances in training classes I've taken where I will draw while seated, but I will not reholster it while seated. I will stand up. You know, so if you're practicing a seated draw, I'll do the exercise, shoot the targets, and then I will stand up before reholstering. I will not reholster my gun while I'm seated. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's important to realize. Secondly, when I'm standing and reholstering, I try to be careful. And some people will take a step back with the leg that's on the side the holster is on. They'll step back and even kind of push the hips forward a little bit to sort of even give you even more safety margin as far as if I make a mistake, it's not pointing at anything. My friend John Johnston proved this, by the way, with a video to address the whole shoot your junk off, you know, thing while reholstering while standing, and wore a holster using, I think, an airsoft gun, or maybe it was a semi-munitions gun, and was intentionally firing off rounds while he's trying, you know, airsoft BBs or sim rounds, while he...
Still scary.
Yeah. I think it was airsoft. intentionally firing those off as he's trying to reholster, and like none of them impacted his leg or his femoral artery, you know, or that kind of thing, or his junk. And so holster positioning is important. Some people will wear this more midline. Okay, that could be a junk issue potentially. But but again, if you're careful with your reholster technique, and if you only do it while standing, and if you understand that this is not going to go off while it's in the holster, you have nothing to worry about as far as that's concerned. Here's the other thing I like about appendix carry is that you can more easily see what you're doing as you're reholstering. And in fact, I encourage and say you should do that. So you should look down at your holster as you're reholstering so that you can see if there's any problems, so that you can see if there's an obstruction in the holster itself, so that you can watch yourself with finger outside of the trigger guard carefully and deliberately and slowly, arguably slowly, inserting this into the holster. You cannot watch it as easily when it's back here and see what's going on.
Can you explain to our new shooters why this watching for obstruction is such so important?
Yeah. I mean, you can get your shirt caught in there. You can get the tassel from a jacket. Anything could get into that holster. And then as you're reholstering, work its way into the trigger guard and depress the trigger.
Yeah. So this is something that happens pretty often. If you're not paying attention, your shirt gets caught and can get hooked on your trigger as you're reholstering and can cause your firearm to discharge. So this is why you need to pay very close attention when you're putting your weapon back away. Now, some people will be in a big hurry. They'll draw really fast, shoot their drills, and then put their gun away really fast. And that's generally not considered to be a good idea. Like, getting your gun out fast is important. Yep. Putting your gun away fast is not so important. So we want to limit the amount of risk that we're going to take for ourselves. So we're going to put that gun away very safely, very smoothly, and very slowly compared to how we get the gun out.
Yeah, exactly. No, you're spot on. I'll just mention a couple other things. And these are things that we think about in our holster design. First of all, you'll notice with the Lexington design, this is even true now of our Revere, which is our light-bearing holster design too. But we try to give people the options, because more options, while it can create some challenges as far as you need to kind of understand what the options are and what you're doing with them. But we want people to be able to set up and customize their holster setup for themselves as best as they can. And so we include this upper portion here you see with all these holes. Mind you, these holes are specifically designed in such a way, like these are a certain size. They're not so big that something is going to get through here. Like a pencil, for instance, will not fit through these holes and get through into that trigger. So sometimes people will be like, well, you're talking about protecting the trigger guard. And also keep in mind that you're generally wearing this inside your waistband, and a lot of that is obstructed anyway. But we have this upper portion called the clip grid, which allows for things like a monoblock to be attached, which is a singular clip that has the two fingers, like I described earlier. You can attach soft loops directly to this clip grid. Soft loops traditionally were made out of leather. Now it's more of a nylon, rubberized nylon material that's reinforced. It's very, very strong. And they have what's called pull-to-dot loops or snaps. So the pull-to-dot snaps mean that you can only pull from the top down to release the snap. You can't torque the loop while it's on the belt in such a way, because like you can imagine if you have a belt passing through that, if that belt got torqued like this, it might pop the snap loose, and it can't do that. Mm-hmm. They only work one direction. And you always want to use two of those for additional redundancy typically as well. And so then you can position soft loops on these, you can position a monoblock on the clip grid, and you can actually change cant with those as well. But then we also have these lower mounting points. so that you can also attach things like a DCC Mod 4 clip, which is what I have here on my holster. You can also attach other types of clips, single clips, two of them. You can attach struts, and then those struts have soft loops attached to them as well. Some people will like that because you can actually, if you want the max adjustability in terms of ride height as well as cant, struts with soft loops is probably the most adjustable that you can go. The point is you kind of have all the options in terms of hardware as far as what you choose to mount this to your belt or your pants with. It'll work with so many options. That's an intentional design choice on our part so that people can customize and set up their gear for them the way they want. Other things, we make sure every corner, every edge is rounded, that there's not a sharp edge anywhere. We don't want your hands getting chewed up. We make sure there's plenty of clearance between the grip and the wing or the claw, because this is a common, in fact, I think Connor on Facebook is asking, he purchased recently a small gun in 380, purchased a quality holster and it has a wing, but the gun is too small to allow for the wing to be used properly. And what I assume you're getting at, Connor, because I see it very commonly, is the gap or the space between the wing and the grip is too narrow. And so you end up chewing up your knuckle, or if you have really large hands or fingers in general, you won't even be able to get between there. I see that very commonly on small gun holsters. We have to specifically, even some of the molds that were made for us, I had to actually change the positioning of this lower, there's two lower screws here, retention screws, so you can change the retention of the holster. It's also what the wing is attached to. I had to reposition those so that we have plenty of space here so I'm not banging my knuckle or my finger on that wing every time.
My first indication of a low quality holster is first the fit and finish, making sure if they don't have their edges rounded and polished, then that's my first clue. And my second clue is if I can't get a good combat grip on that pistol.
If there's something about the holster itself, including the wing, or you have a sweat guard, for instance, that like that obstructs your ability to get the web of your hand into the grip, which is another more of an issue on like your leather backed hybrid holsters. Used to be more of a thing with that. But here's the other thing. We make sure that the Kydex, like we want to cover the trigger guard, but we have to do it very carefully and tastefully, meaning that we don't want to be hitting our finger, our middle finger on the Kydex or drawing the gun. We want our finger to go up against the bottom of the trigger guard. And I see some where there's too much material here. We want it to be the length it ought to be for the chosen carry position, but we also want it to be narrow. From left to right, as you're looking at it, you know, on the waistband. And we try to remove any excess material down in this region below where the wing and the other hardware is attached, because it's unnecessary to have material there at that point. And we try to make sure there's not like a sharp corner down here, especially, which is one I see on lower quality holsters all the time, where this Kydex material down to the muzzle end extends further and sometimes has a very sharp corner down there. It's like, if you're carrying appendix, you don't want that at all. You want this to be as rounded and as narrow as possible, because we want to reduce, once we get past this wing and this hardware that's attached, that's why that's there. But once we get past that, which is just forward of the trigger guard, we want to narrow that as much as we can. To minimize that footprint and increases comfort, mostly. That's a big part. So comfort's important. Concealment's important. There's a lot that goes into, and I haven't even touched on all the things, but those are some of the things that maybe gives you sort of a sense of there's a lot that goes into the design, the making, the use of a holster. And most of this stuff is stuff I've learned from experience of, well, that sucks. I don't like that. That doesn't work very well.
Mm-hmm. It's a very common thing for experienced gun owners to have a big box of holsters that they don't wear anymore. Because you just go through trying this one, trying that one. And fortunately, I mean, when you and I got started, there wasn't quite as much information out there on all this stuff as there is now. But there are so many people out there with tons of opinions, and you can go and find some pretty decent quality holsters that are going to work for me right off the bat.
Yeah. And Connor confirms, he says, it's exactly the issue, because I suspect that was the case, because I've experienced it. I've seen it. That's what I'm talking about here. Yeah. He can't get his fingers between the grip and the wing. That gap is too narrow. So Connor, if it's using a mod wing like this, it's not necessarily recommended, or I don't necessarily like it, but you can actually cut down the top of the mod wing even down to just above where the screw and the nut is located that holds it on. So you can cut that down. I've done that actually a time or two on a couple holsters. And if it's not using a mod wing, you may still be able to cut down other types of wings, or you can probably convert over to a mod wing and cut it down. Because most of these wings or claws use a 5/8 inch hole pattern, which is what exactly what this hole patterning here is. Yeah. And so that's what I would probably look at doing, Connor, just so you can make that holster work. Cause I'd love to say, hey, I'll make you one for a Springfield 911 in 380, but we don't make a holster for that right now. So, and probably won't, cause they're just not common enough. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that goes into holsters, and there's more we can go into, but that's probably plenty for today.
Good for the basics.
Yeah.
And we got more topics on here, but I think we're going to have to do a part two.
We're splitting this into part two. Yep. We suspected that would be the case. And so what are we still going to talk about in part two?
We still have belts. Yep. So a lot of people don't think belts are an essential part of your equipment. If you're going to have a holster, you got to have a good belt. We got range gear coming up, basic range gear. What do you need to go to the range for live fire so that you don't look like a dork out there? How we're going to go over that. Storage, incredibly important. A lot of people, especially new gun owners, don't think about storage. How are you going to keep that gun locked up and safe, especially around kids, traveling, all that kind of stuff. And then we're going to get into some apparel, clothing. What kind of things might you wear that will make your concealed carry journey a little bit more efficient and comfortable?
Sounds like a good part two episode. So that's where we'll wrap this one up for today then. A reminder of our episode sponsors, KSGArmory.com, mm-hmm. mentioned right in the beginning. And obviously you saw, those of you watching, a KSG Armory Lexington holster. We sell a couple of different holster models, the Lexington, the Declaration, which is a very simplified holster. It's designed to be optimized for use with things like a Filster Enigma holster mounting system. You got the Revere, which is our light bearing holster line. We've got the Filster Classic models. So Filster is another company, technically a competitor, but we're friends with those guys, and we have some of their old molds for their classic line holsters that some people still like, and so we still make that because Filster got out of the game of making those, and those are kind of a cool design. They work really well, but they're only available in right-handed configuration, unfortunately. KSGArmory.com. Speaking of, I do want to go ahead and give it. I mean, I've given a shout out to Filster Holsters. Great folks, great quality products. I have no problem doing that. I mean, we love to sell you KSG Army holsters, but guys, Filster is a great company. Henry Holster is a great company. In fact, those two companies right there are some of the innovators in today's holster world. And so many things of what we know, things that we do at KSG Armory, are a direct result of work that guys like John at Filster and Sarah, I should say, John and Sarah now, of course, they've been married for a few years and they work very well together at Filster. Andrew over at Henry Holsters, those guys we owe a lot to, and I respect the heck out of them. And we could be competitors and still be friends in this space. There's plenty of room for all of us to play, mm-hmm. you know, in the holster market, if you will. Also, Dark Star Gear, Tom over at Dark Star, great guy. They're a great company. Love him to death. Great products. Tony at JM Custom Kydex, another great company. Awesome product. Those are definitely four top of mind companies that I have no problems making recommendation. They make quality stuff. And here's the other thing. All of those people actually shoot, actually train, actually carry on a daily basis, actually know what they're talking about. Know, like, they work with their stuff. They use their stuff. They test their stuff. And I'd like to say we do the same too, right? And then that's another difference. Like, I promise you, Connor, he's the one that had the issue with his wing and the grip and all that not working, not fitting, you know. I promise you that the guy that makes that holster would not have made it that way if he actually used that holster with that gun for any amount of time. And maybe he does, but maybe he draws wrong, meaning Like, and we see this sometimes where instead of actually grabbing the combat grip, like they kind of pinch it like this until they get it out and then they fix their grip. Like that guy, that could totally be that guy, that major holster Connor that uses some janky grip, which is not optimal, which is potentially unsafe.
Oh yeah.
Because he doesn't train or shoot enough.
If you have a holster that makes you use a funky grip just to get it out, that's so dangerous. Yeah. Especially like I've seen people fumble a gun out on the range and then try to catch it, you know, and then a finger goes into the trigger guard and you pull the trigger on it. Like that's a very, you don't want that.
Oh, and I just remember that's the fourth, you know, rule, as we call it, of holsters that we teach at concealedcarry.com is we talked about the the safety of the trigger guard and retaining the gun and retaining to you the holster. The fourth thing is it's got to be designed in such a way that actually allows you to access the gun.
Yes.
Because what's the point of carrying it if you can't actually access it? And access means that I can grip this the way I'm going to shoot it, because that's what you want. And that's, we've already explained that that's some of the thought that goes behind how a KSG Armory holster is designed. Anyway, sponsor, KSGArmory.com.
Paired very well with our next sponsor,
which is
EDC Belt Company.
EDC Belt Company. We didn't get into talking about belts specifically here today. That'll be next time. But you want a quality belt, and the EDC Belt Company Foundation Belt is specifically designed for concealment, specifically designed for appendix carry. However, it also works very well with other more traditional forms of carrying a gun on a belt. Infinitely adjustable, super high quality. I mean, like the one I'm wearing, I've had for years now at this point.
Good for air travel.
Very good. Yeah. Like the buckle on them is actually brass. It's a nylon, or excuse me, a nickel coated brass, which does not set off metal detectors. So I go right through security all the time, just wearing my foundation belt. It's never been a problem. They never even ask about it. If they happen to see it, sometimes they'll be like, "You'll need to remove your belt." And I'm like, it'll go through just fine. And I had like one guy that's like, "No, you need to remove your belt." I'm like, "Fine." But yeah, I usually can walk right through, no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's our sponsors today. And also again, concealedcarry.com, which you guys should already be familiar with. This is the Concealed Carry Podcast after all. That's all the time we have for today. We'll see you next time for part two of this third installment of the Uncensored Beginner's Guide to Training series. Anything else, Brian or Doc?
Hey, be ready for whatever the mountain throws at you.
And I will leave you with a reminder to train right, train often, and train safe so you can fight hard, fight fast, and fight true. Take care, guys.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. Concealed Carry Inc., its brands and properties, and the Concealed Carry Podcast is not a legal service, nor are we attorneys at law. We make our best faith effort to share concealed carry-related insights and information about firearm-related incidents and the laws pertaining based on our own understanding and experience. But things can be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in this podcast. Please exercise care with all things pertaining to firearm use, concealed carry, and always practice following basic firearm safety rules. More information about safety can be found at concealedcarry.com/safety.